Hello and welcome to In the News. I'm Chris. I'm Rick Anderson, and today I'll be reading selected stories from the science section of the New York Times edition of February 7th, 2024. Our first story says, How Earth Might Have Turned Into a Snowball. A team of scientists think that the planet may have been thrust into its longest ice age because of gas leaked out of volcanoes. The story is by Katrina Miller. Around 717 million years ago, Earth's humid landscapes and roiling blue waters transformed into a frigid, barren world. Scientists nicknamed this stage of geological history, and others like it, Snowball Earth. What exactly froze the planet nearly solid has been a mystery, as it has remained for that way for 56 million years. Recently, a team of researchers at the University of Sydney said they have it figured out. Earth's glaciation, they say, may have come from a global drop in carbon dioxide emissions, a result of fewer volcanoes expelling the gas into the atmosphere. Less carbon dioxide makes it more difficult for the Earth's atmosphere to trap heat. If the depletion were extreme enough, they argued, it could have thrust the planet into its longest ice age yet. The theory, published in the journal Geology, adds insight to the way geological processes influenced Earth's past climate. It may also help scientists better understand trends in our current climate. These days, of course, humans are having a large impact on CO2 in the atmosphere, said Adriana Dutkiewicz, a sedimentologist at the University of Sydney who led the study. Back in time, there were no humans, and so everything was basically modulated by geological processes. There are many ideas about what turned the Earth into a snowball. One popular theory suggests that minerals released by the weathering of igneous rock sucked enough carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to set off a deep freeze. Perhaps that helped kick off a global glaciation, Dr. Dutkiewicz said, but it couldn't have kept Earth frozen for 56 million years on its own. So there was, and there has to be, another mystery mechanism that would have sustained that glaciation for that long, she said. Dr. Dutkiewicz and her colleagues turned their eyes to volcanoes because of a newly available model of Earth's shifting tectonic plates. As the continents spread apart, they studied the changing length of the mid-ocean ridge, a chain of underwater volcanoes predicted by the model. The team then calculated the amount of volcanic gas at the beginning of and throughout the ice age. Their results showed a drop in atmospheric carbon dioxide sufficient to initiate and sustain a 56 million year glaciation. A reduction in volcanic gas emissions has been proposed as an explanation for Snowball Earth before, but according to Dr. Dutkiewicz, this is the first time researchers have proved that the mechanism was viable through modeled computations. Dietmar Müller, a geophysicist at the University of Sydney and an author of the study, said the work was one way to distinguish between alternative models for this very important ancient part of Earth's evolution. If scientists know there was an ice age, Dr. Müller explained, then we can say this one reconstruction model is perhaps more likely than the other one. Of course, a model is just that, a model. Without real-world data to back it up, the researchers can't rule out other possibilities. One thing about geology, there are no definite answers, Dr. Dutkiewicz said. Based on a combination of different lines of evidence, we can suggest that this is a very likely process. Francis McDonald, a geologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who was not involved in the work, said studies like this were important for learning why climates fail. He is hesitant to readily accept outcomes from models of the ancient seafloor because there is little data revealing what Earth's oceanic crust was like at that time. How do we actually test that? Dr. McDonald asked about the team's model. I think it's a really big challenge. Still, Dr. Miller thinks it is important to try to put bounds on the amount of volcanic gas emitted in the past, particularly when it comes to running climate models for the future. Usually, that's the most uncertain parameter, he said. Research like this can help scientists distinguish the influence of geological activity from human-induced climate change. But could a natural drop in volcanic emissions ever save us from the amount of carbon we have pumped into our atmosphere today? Unfortunately not, Dr. Dutkowitz said. We can study these ancient perturbations, she added, but the human-induced change is a different kind of beast. And return to our next story, which says, why do women have more autoimmune diseases? Study points to X chromosome. The molecules that silence a woman's second X chromosome can confuse the immune system, a new study suggests. The story is by Carl Zimmer. Women are much more likely than men to have their immune system turned against them, resulting in an array of so-called autoimmune diseases like lupus and multiple sclerosis. A study published recently offers an explanation rooted in the X chromosome. The research published in the journal Cell suggests that a special set of molecules that action the extra X chromosome carried by women can sometimes confuse the immune system. Independent experts said that the molecules are unlikely to be the sole reason autoimmune disease skews female. But if the results hold up in further experiments, it might be possible to base new treatments on these molecules rather than on the current drugs that blunt the entire immune system. Maybe that's a better strategy, said Dr. Howard Chang, a geneticist and dermatologist at Stanford who led the new study. Male and female embryos carry 22 identical pairs of chromosomes. The 23rd pair is different. Females carry two X's, while males carry an X and a Y, which lead to the development of male sex organs. Each chromosome holds genes that, when switched on, produce proteins to do work instead of cells. You might expect that women with two copies of X would make twice as many X proteins as men do. Instead, they produce about the same level. That's because one of the two X chromosomes is silenced. A molecule called Xist clings to the second X chromosome like Velcro, Dr. Chang says. As hundreds of Xist molecules wrap themselves around the X chromosome, they completely shut it down. Keeping one X silent is crucial to women's health. If a gene on the second one escapes Xist's control, it will result in an excess supply of proteins, some of which could be toxic. In 2015, it occurred to Dr. Chang about the silencing itself might also have a downside. His epiphany occurred when he was preparing to take his medical board exams to renew his license as a dermatologist. As part of his studies, Dr. Chang had to brush up on autoimmune diseases, memorizing the names of human proteins that can be targeted by a misdirected immune system. When he looked up the list, he was surprised to see some familiar names. When Dr. Chang isn't working as a dermatologist, he researches the X chromosome in his lab. He noticed that many of the proteins involved in autoimmune diseases also helped Xist silence the X chromosome. Maybe, Dr. Chang thought, that was no coincidence. The new study emerged from years of research testing his hunch that Xist molecules could cause autoimmune disease. He and his colleagues studied a strain of mice in which the females are at high risk of the autoimmune disease lupus, while the males never develop severe cases. The researchers genetically engineered the male mice so that they, like females, produced Xist. Once the male mice express Xist, they get much worse levels of immune disease, Dr. Chang said. The researchers also found that people with lupus or two other autoimmune disorders had high levels of antibodies to excess-related proteins in the blood. Dr. Chang suspects the autoimmune diseases may come about during the normal process of cells dying in a woman's body. The cells split open, dumping their molecules into the bloodstream. In women, that debris includes a lot of excess molecules and the proteins attached to them. When an immune cell encounters an excess molecule, it also finds a huge number of proteins stuck to it. This unusual experience may confuse immune cells, which then mistakenly start making antibodies to the excess proteins. Once the immune system starts treating excess proteins as the enemy, they start attacking other parts of the body as well. That's because every cell sticks fragments of its proteins on its surface where immune cells can inspect them. If an immune cell encounters an excess protein fragment, Dr. Chang proposed, it will kill the cell that presents it. Montserrat Aguera, a geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania who was not involved in the study, said the scenario was plausible. But she also noted that some people make antibodies to these same proteins, including men, without developing autoimmune diseases. Dr. Melissa Lechner, an endocrinologist at UCLA, who was also not involved in the work, said that while the new study was intriguing, it was possible that the excess proteins only boost autoimmunity rather than acting as a causal trigger. The data doesn't let me distinguish between the two, she said. Some studies suggest that the X chromosome fuels autoimmune diseases in other ways. For instance, it carries a number of genes for proteins that act as signals between immune cells. If one of these genes escapes silencing, it may create extra signals to confuse the immune system. The challenge the scientists now face is in figuring out how all these factors work collectively to produce the female bias in autoimmune diseases. This is biology. It is a beautiful thing, but it's frustrating, Dr. O'Gara said. And return to our next story, where it says, NASA spots signs of twin volcanic plumes on Jupiter's moon, Io. The second pair of close flybys adds to the treasure trove of data that scientists have about Jupiter's volcanic moon. The story is also by Katrina Miller. Recently, NASA's Juno orbiter got a second close-up with Io, Jupiter's third largest moon, and the most volcanic world of our solar system. The Juno spacecraft, which arrived at the gas giant in 2016, is on an extended mission to explore Jupiter's rings and moon. Its latest flyby, which complemented the mission's first close approach on December 30th, yielded even more views of the moon's hellish landscape. Io's violent expulsions of sulfur and additional compounds give the moon its orange, yellow, and blue hues. The process is similar to what happens around the volcanoes of Hawaii, or the geysers in Yellowstone National Park, according to Scott Bolton, a physicist at the Southwest Research Institute, who leads the Juno mission. That must be what Io is like, on steroids, he said. He added it probably smells like those places, too. The most recent shots of Juno are already ripe for discovery, Dr. Bolton saw on the surface of Io, what appears to be a double volcanic plume spewing into space, something that Juno has never caught before that. Other scientists are noticing new lava flows and changes to familiar features posted in past space missions like the Galileo probe, which made numerous flybys Io in the 1990s and 2000s. That's the beauty of Io, said Johnny Radibor, a planetary scientist at Brigham Young University, who is not part of the Juno mission but collaborates with the team on Io observations. Unlike our own moon, which remains frozen in time, Dr. Radibor said, Io changes every day, every minute, every second. images from the twin flybys during which the spacecraft came within 930 miles of Io will be combined with previous snapshots NASA has captured of the Jovian moon. The goal, Dr. Bolton said, is to understand what's really behind the engine that's driving all the volcanoes, because they're all over the place. That might be a global magma ocean just beneath Io's crust, or merely pockets of molten rock under the surface, like the ones that fuel Earth's volcanoes. It could be weeks, even months, before scientists begin to find answers in the data. This is the last close flyby that Juno will make of Io, but the mission will continue to conduct more distant observations every 60 days, giving mission specialists a picture of the ever-changing moon as a whole. That data will be just as valuable, according to Dr. Bolton. All the images are amazing. We never really know what to expect. We turn now to an interesting story that says, the dogs that live longest by a nose. Small dogs with prominent noses live longer than bigger, flat-faced canines, a new study suggests. The story is by Emily Anthes. All dogs go to heaven, but a bulldog might find itself headed there years before a border terrier, according to a new study of nearly 600,000 British dogs from more than 150 breeds. Large breeds and breeds with flattened faces had shorter average lifespans than smaller dogs and those with elongated snouts, that the researchers found. Female dogs also lived slightly longer than male ones. The results were published recently in Scientific Reports. There are exceptions to those broad trends, and trendings in the findings might not apply to dogs outside of Britain, where breeding practices and gene pools may be different, the researchers noted. More research will be needed to determine why some breeds have shorter lifespans than others. Some breeds are genetically predisposed to serious health problems, but breed-related differences in behavior, lifestyle, diet, environment, or other factors could also play a role in shortening some dogs' lives, experts said. Now that we have identified these populations that are at risk of early death, we can start looking into why that is, said Kirsten McMillan, an author of the new study and the data manager for the welfare charity in Britain that led the research. This provides an opportunity for us to improve the lives of our dogs. The study is based on a database of 584,734 British dogs, which the researchers assembled from breed registries, pet insurance companies, veterinary companies, and other sources. These types of records, which can be prone to various biases, are not necessarily representative of Britain's general canine population, the scientists acknowledge. But Dr. Audrey Ruppel, a veterinary epidemiologist at Virginia Tech, who was not involved in the study, said the researchers' use of so many different data sources was one of the study's strengths. I think this is a fantastic approach, she said. Most of the dogs were purebred, representing one of 155 breeds. The rest were combined into a single crossbreed category. The researchers categorized each breed's overall body size as small, medium, or large, and its head shape as flat-faced, medium-proportioned, or long-faced. Across all dogs, the median lifespan was 12.5 years. The researchers found that the average lifespan varied quite spectacularly among breeds, Dr. McMillan said. Lancashire Healers, a breed of petite herding dogs, were the canine Methuselahs, living for an average of 15.4 years. But much larger Caucasian shepherd dogs, though, had an average lifespan of just 5.4 years. As a group, small breeds lived for 12.7 years on average, compared to 11.9 years for large breeds. This was consistent with prior research on dogs and other mammals, which has generally found that Within a given species, smaller individuals tend to outlive larger ones. Flat-faced breeds, which are called brachycephalic, are live for 11.2 years on average, while medium and long-faced breeds had average lifespans of 12.8 and 12.1 years. Some flat-faced breeds, like the French Bulldog, which have become wildly popular, but experts have warned that their extremely short snouts can lead to respiratory problems, heat stroke, and other health challenges. Some of the traits associated with shorter lifespans also appear to compound one another, the researchers found. As a group, small, long-nosed breeds, such as miniature dachshunds and whippets, lived 13.3 years on average, roughly 2.5 years longer than large, short-nosed breeds, such as boxers and bull mastiffs, which together had a life average expectancy of 10.7 years. Evolutionary history played a role, too. Closely related breeds had more similar life expectancies. The researchers also found that purebred dogs as a group had average lifespans of 12.7 years compared with 12.0 years for crossbreed dogs. That survival advantage for purebred dogs contradicts some prior research and could stem from the fact that all crossbred dogs, regardless of size or breed mix, were combined into a single category, scientists said. But Dr. Ruppel said that she was glad to see results that challenged the conventional wisdom that mixed breed dogs are always healthier than their purebred counterparts. "I think it is a more complex question than that," she said. "There are pure breeds of dogs that are generally pretty healthy." And in our final story of the day, the changing focus of climate denial from science to scientists. The scientist Michael Mann is challenging attacks on his work in a defamation suit that has taken 12 years to come to trial. The story is by Diger Erdesanaya. One morning in 2012, climate scientist Michael Mann woke up to a terse email from a fellow scientist. "Holy crap," read the message from Phil Plait, an astronomer and science communicator. "This is truly the most awful thing I've ever seen about a climate scientist. If someone wrote this about me, I'd be calling a lawyer." A conservative media outlet and right-leaning research organization had published commentaries comparing Dr. Mann, then a professor at Pennsylvania State University, with Jerry Sandusky, the one-time Penn State football coach convicted of sexually assaulting multiple children. The writers claimed that Dr. Mann had created fraudulent graphs and accused the university of mishandling investigations into both the coach's crimes and scientists' researches. Dr. Mann did indeed call a lawyer. He sued the writers and their publishers for libel and slander. Now, 12 years later, after a pinball journey through the obstacle course of free speech and defamation law, the case is being tried in District of Columbia Superior Court. The case is being only the two writers, as individuals, are on trial. A verdict is expected as soon as next week. For me to be compared to Jerry Sandusky as the father of a six-year-old girl was maybe the worst thing that I've ever experienced, Dr. Mann testified at court recently. I felt like a pariah in my own community. The court case has played out over a time period when outright denial of climate science has decreased, but scientists' integrity has become a bigger target. "The nature of climate denial has changed," said Colm Hood, head of research at the advocacy organization the Center for Countering Digital Hate. The group recently published a report analyzing YouTube videos, which found that personal attacks on scientists are now one of the most common types of online content dismissing climate change. The lawsuit has also caught the attention of climate scientists and legal scholars, among others. This trial marks some of the very few instances in American courts that a climate scientist has taken the stand to defend their research. According to Michael Girard, the faculty director at Columbia University's Sabin Center for Climate Change Law, it's a rare case when a climate scientist is fighting back against climate deniers, said Mr. Girard, who is also a member of the board of directors of the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, which previously helped Dr. Mann with a different legal battle. Because Dr. Mann is legally considered a public figure, he must clear a higher bar than most people would in order to win a defamation lawsuit. He faces the difficult task of proving authors he sued knowingly lied in their writings. The authors have argued that their posts were merely stating opinions. Their publishers also petitioned the Supreme Court unsuccessfully to review the case. Catherine Hayhoe, a chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy and a professor at Texas Tech University, said that Dr. Mann's case resonates among other climate scientists. I cannot go one day without being attacked, she said. He's fighting for all of us. In court, Dr. Mann is defending his famous research, which was published in the late 1990s and showed average temperatures in the northern hemisphere rising so sharply in recent decades that their graphs resemble the shape of a hockey stick. The research came under fire in 2009 in an incident known as ClimateGate, when hackers broke into a computer server at the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia and released thousands of emails between scientists, including Dr. Mann. Skeptics seized on the emails to claim he had manipulated data to exaggerate the hockey stick graph. Penn State investigated his research, as did the National Science Foundation, the Department of Commerce, and others. All cleared Dr. Mann of misconduct. Before and after the outcry, other scientists have replicated his findings using different data sources and statistical methods. The matter seemed settled until 2012, when Mr. Sandusky was convicted, and the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation published a report that said the administration at Penn State had failed to stop that coach's criminal actions. The day after that report's release, Rand Simberg, at the time an adjunct scholar at Competitive Enterprise Institute, published a blog post on the think tank's website comparing Dr. Mann to Mr. Sandusky. Mann could be said to be Jerry Sandusky of climate science, except that part about molesting children. He has molested and tortured data in the service of politicizing science that could have dire economic consequences, Mr. Simberg wrote. A few days later, Mark Stein, an author and then guest host at the conservative radio and television shows, republished part of Mr. Simberg's post on the National Review online. Michael Mann was the man behind the fraudulent climate change hockey stick graph, is the very ringmaster of the tree ring service, Dr. Stein said as he added his own commentary. In short order, Dr. Mann filed his lawsuit. And that's all the time we have for today. This has been Rick Anderson reading selected stories from the New York Times edition of February 7th, 2023. Thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. And hey, let's do this again next week.